The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Once again, it's very complex for me to talk about it because I know that there are some people who go to protest, and I know how scary it must feel to protest when you don't know what happens to you after that. But for those who decide to stay silent, I don't think there's a lot of respect. And I'm telling this here, you know, in a cozy place as I ran away, saying that people who are experienced the bombings, their views are, of course, much worse than mine, and even it doesn't matter whether they are Russian-speaking, Ukrainian-speaking, or even international students, because Kharkiv is a home to a lot of international students, too. I don't think that they are, like, they're good Russians, not all Russians, or any of that.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 8th, 2022. Katerina is a fourth-year law student at a university in Kharkiv, Ukraine. At least, she was until a few days ago. That's when the Russian army came in and started bombarding the town she grew up in and studies in. I met her on Sunday on Twitter, of all places, when she posted some comments that I thought were particularly interesting. We got to chatting, and before I knew it, we were on a recorded line in the virtual jungle studio talking about life as a Russian-speaking Ukrainian in Kharkiv before and after the invasion, talking about getting out of town and ultimately out of the country and being a refugee law student in an adjacent country. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 8th, a conversation with a refugee law student from Kharkiv. So I want to start with just who you are. We met this morning my time on Twitter. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you and where are you and how did you come to be there?
Hello, and thank you for your invitation. My name is Katerina, and I'm a law student. I'm a fourth-year law student in Yaroslav Mudry National Law University, which is located in Kharkiv, Ukraine. I have studied there, and I have lived in the city for almost my entire life. And currently, I'm located in Czech Republic because together with my mom and brother, we had to flee the city.
All right, so there's a lot to unpack there, but I wanted to start with, for those listeners who don't have Slavic languages or speak or understand the demographics of Ukraine at all, you have a very Ukrainian sounding last name, but you have grown up in a city that is in the eastern part of Ukraine, which people often think of as a sort of Russian-speaking section, and in Kharkiv, which the Russians, you know, sort of describe as this sort of occupied Ukrainian territory where Russians are mistreated. So I'm curious how you describe yourself ethnically. Are you Russian-speaking Ukrainian? Are you Ukrainian? Are you Russian? How do you describe yourself in the Ukrainian demographic discussion?
Yes, that's a very complex question. Thank you for that. But I have before, I have to just say that, you know, all the views are my personal. I do not represent, you know, every person who lives in Kharkiv. It's entirely my perspective. I'm not a historian. I'm not a politician. I'm a law student. And frankly, I'm not that great at law, but Kharkiv currently is a Russian-speaking city. But it hasn't been always this way. If you have heard of it, during the Soviet times, during the Russian Empire rule, there were politics of Russification, basically banning Ukrainian literature, Ukrainian art. Probably the most notable example is the example of the 20s in the USSR, when the Soviets came to power and Kharkiv became the capital of the Soviet Republic, they started encouraging Ukrainian literature, Ukrainian culture, as they did in all of the conquered republics. But then in the 30s, the situation got worse, and suddenly a lot of poets, a lot of writers, artists got repressed, and also there was the Holodomor, the genocide of Ukrainian people. So Kharkiv, which was a very Ukrainian-speaking city, from that point, it was a turning point for it to become a Russified city. Basically, the idea of Soviet Union was that it's, you know, there is no nationality, there's only class in Soviet Union, but there was a nationality. It was just that everybody had to speak Russian. Like my mom, she lived in Tajikistan, for instance, or Chelyabinsk, and she spoke their Russian. So Kharkiv is indeed a Russian-speaking city. But if you go to countryside, a lot of people speak, for instance, Surzhik, which is a combination of Ukrainian and Russian. It's considered slightly illiterate. I wouldn't treat it as illiterate, but it's people adopting words from Russian and Ukrainian. Some people speak Ukrainian very clearly, but Kharkiv is a Russified city, and many big cities in the east of Ukraine are. But still, you know, I went to a Russian-speaking school back when it was possible. I treated Russian as native language until the Revolution of Dignity and the war that was started in 2014 and the annexation of Crimea. But, you know...
And how old were you then?
I was 14 or 13, but I was watching the news and I was very worried. I said to my mom, look, I want to go and protest in Kharkiv, but of course she didn't allow me to do that. But some of my friends actually did it. But for me, that was a turning point of my identification. Like I have mostly Ukrainian roots, but I have small percentage of Russian roots, but I have never identified as Russian. And honestly, I do not know any person of my age who has ever said, I want to live in Russia. And some who do, they just go and study there. But nobody wants to be, I don't know any, you know, sane person who has ever wanted for Ukraine to become part of Russia. I know that maybe some older people who are nostalgic about Soviet Union, maybe some of them might express anything like that, but I was lucky enough not to hear such suggestions. But even the conservative people, they don't want to be part of Russia, even though majority of people speak Russian, we consume some of Russian culture. I distance myself from it, but a lot of people like listen to Russian singers, like read Russian literature, but still identify as Ukrainians, especially after the Revolution of Dignity.
So you think of yourself as Ukrainian, plain and simple, and in 2014, you kind of made a decision that you regarded Ukrainian, not Russian, as your native language. Is that a fair summary?
Not really. I'd say I'm not strong enough to switch to Ukrainian. I still speak Russian mostly. I try to speak Ukrainian. I speak Ukrainian. For instance, our law obliges us, people who work you know, in restaurants, they have to speak Ukrainian with you, and I always do that. But my family, it speaks in Russian. Most of my friends do. But I try to switch, to use as much Ukrainian as possible. But it's difficult for me, not because I don't know the language, but because everybody speaks, and, you know, you have to switch constantly. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that I'm Russian. It never meant. Right. And actually, like, even if I talk to someone from Russia and I suddenly use Ukrainian words, they just don't understand what I've said, even if it's something that I thought could be very easy to understand.
So in Ukraine, law is an undergraduate degree, right? So in the United States, it's something people do after taking the bachelor's degree, but in most of Europe, and I assume in Ukraine, it's your initial university degree. Is that right?
Yes, this is correct.
And so you're basically in your fourth year of what we would call college or university, and all of a sudden there's a war and the Russians are attacking your hometown.
Yes. There just to be no doubts or anything, my law degree is completely taught in Ukrainian. We also have English, but it's just all the university education is in Ukrainian. And of course, when I get to my university, I speak Ukrainian there, not Russian.
Interesting. Okay, so let's back up. How many weeks ago were you just a law student in Kharkiv and you know, everything was normal?
It was actually, I think, a week ago, a little bit more, but the war broke on February 24, and, you know, a lot of people in Ukraine say that now I don't know what day week it is, I just know what day war it is. So yeah, it broke out pretty recently. We were actually on a break and just about to go back to university to seminars and lectures, but currently we are on a break. It's a 2-week break, and we'll see what goes after that.
And just to be clear, you know, U.S. intelligence was saying as loudly as it could that this war was coming. A lot of people didn't seem to believe it. Some people did seem to believe it. How did you react? What was your understanding of the situation as the Olympics were winding down and the United States is saying, you know, there's going to be an invasion of Ukraine, and a lot of people were kind of doubting that? Did you have a sense of this war as coming, or did it really take you by surprise?
Well, here I can only speak on my behalf because everybody had their different moods. I'm a very paranoid person. So I've actually booked a trip to Lviv on February 24th because I was afraid that especially after watching, I couldn't find any will to watch that speech. But after reading the bullet points of Putin's speech, I've realized that he's actually gonna start the war. I just didn't expect it to go that way. What I thought his strategy would be is to start from the LPR and DPR and then extend. But if you want to, I can share the very moment how I found out. But just to make sure, I was all of the previous week, I was very stressed. I was always reading the news, reading the analysis. I couldn't focus on my work. I couldn't focus on anything. I couldn't sleep well. I was watching the UN meetings. So I was really afraid, but I was hoping that, you know, that it's some, I don't know, geopolitics or something. But as it got closer and closer, I stacked my clothes to Lviv. I just said that I wanted to go on a break to Lviv for my mental health, and my parents actually were planning to go to Egypt the next day. But I remember very clearly, you know, on February 23rd, we went grocery shopping. My brother and I played basketball. And then I went to bed. I couldn't fall asleep. I was watching the UN meeting. And then I read the news that their civilian flights are restricted in Ukraine and that there are shellings in Mariupol, which is Ukrainian-controlled territory near LPR and DPR. So it meant that they started attacking Ukrainian-controlled territory, but it is still far away from my home. At that day, I decided to stay with my parents because my mental health was not in the best condition. So I go to them and I say, look, they closed the sky. You cannot go to Egypt. It seems like the war has started. We have to pack now and go somewhere. Let's go to Lviv. And my mom is, you know, very strict person. She says, you're being paranoid, go to sleep. And then she wakes me up in 2 hours, I guess, and says, she doesn't say anything like the war has started. She just says, pack everything, we are leaving. And I was afraid to ask what's going on. I understood, but I just didn't want to ask. I didn't want to hear the actual words. So I think I didn't answer your question properly, but I'm sorry, I was slightly...
No. You answered it very fully. So Kharkiv and Lviv are not close. They're, you know, a kind of opposite ends of the country. Where did you go once you decided you were getting out of town?
I also must be very clear here. I try not to share the routes because a lot of Ukrainians are trying, especially people from Kharkiv, trying to flee. Like a lot of my friends are currently on the road. We just went to our country house, far from Kharkiv, but there was still, we could hear explosions distantly, and we could hear, once there was a big explosion near us, and it felt like something hit our roof twice. And that was the moment we lived at that country house in fear. We were afraid to go upstairs. I was afraid to walk around. And we realized that we cannot go on like this.
So how long were you there before you left the country entirely?
Actually, I think it was 2 or 3 days. But we understand, like we left my uncle and our cat there so he could take care of her. I feel that I regret it to an extent, but they're relatively safe. It's a safe city. Nothing is going on there because, you know, sometimes it's good when you buy something, some property in the middle of nowhere. But still, we traveled for 3 maybe days. I don't know. Everything was so mixed up, you know, the day and night. I almost didn't sleep. Then I woke up lately. So we traveled a lot, but eventually we went to Czech Republic with my brother, my mom, and I.
And, you know, we've heard a lot about refugees in Poland, refugees in Germany, refugees in some of the Baltic countries, less about Ukrainian refugees in the Czech Republic. Why did you end up there? Why did you go there? And how has the reception been among Czech people?
I would say this, that we just had friends and they have helped us a lot with accommodation. But formally, I'm still not a refugee in Ukraine. There is this rule that you can travel to European Union for 90 days, without visa, unless you want to work there, but you can stay there for 90 days. So currently I'm just using this rule, but if I do this, I, for instance, don't have, you know, the Medicare. I don't have some of the privileges people who decided to become refugees here have. But the reception is okay overall. I haven't seen anybody saying anything cool. I've seen Ukrainian flags in different places. I've seen that they're trying to, you know, to find and to carry the humanitarian help to Ukraine. But, you know, our town is a little bit, you know, it's not a big town, it's not Prague, so it's not like there where there are huge marches as in many European capitals, but I haven't met any xenophobia. I was, you know, treated very well, and I hope it will continue.
And what are your plans? I mean, are you just planning to wait out the war and then go back? Or do you just not make plans at this point because the situation is so uncertain?
I'm currently trying to wait and see, because the positions inside of my family differ. Like, I have one plan, my parents have another plan, and we're currently, you know, debating. But I'm trying just, you know, my main goal now is to finish the university so I have my diploma. Because without this diploma, I cannot become a lawyer anywhere, like in Ukraine or in the EU or anywhere else. So I hope that, I hope that I will be, and my colleagues will be able to get the diploma. I'm also trying to work remotely, but currently everybody was busy, of course, with other things. But currently I'm trying to figure the plan out, but you know, I'm also trying to realize what's going on, and I know it's bad, especially when people are suffering in Ukraine, but I'm just very grateful that I'm under the peaceful sky, and you know, that I can walk, and when I hear the sirens, it doesn't mean that I have to, you know, go somewhere and hide. So I'm just trying to probably to relax for some time, but also thinking of plans for the future.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20. So I want to ask you about some of the Russian claims about Ukraine. If you listen to Vladimir Putin, the Ukrainian government is a bunch of Nazis and fascists who are committing genocide against people like you, that is, Eastern Ukrainians who are Russian-speaking. So I just want to ask you, first of all, as a Russian-speaking Eastern Ukrainian, do you feel oppressed by your government?
I have actually, you know, when I talk about Kharkiv, for instance, I tell that I don't have proper words. And I think this is the case too. I think what he says is, it's very disrespectful to people who have actually suffered the genocide. I think it's not only cynical, I just think that it's, I don't know, inhuman thing to say. I know that there are crimes against humanity, like maybe you've heard of Izolyatsiya camp. They were, even before the full escalation, that was the camp where people were imprisoned. And, you know, atrocities were made to them by Russian-backed separatists or Russian occupants. But I have never heard of anything like that. Actually, a lot of refugees have, after the 2014, they had to go to Kharkiv. And they were much more radical in being Ukrainian supporters than I am. They said things, and I was like, why do you hate that culture that much? And now I see, because they have felt it on their own skin, how, you know, how terrible that culture could be to them. So, I mean, even using the word genocide, like, I've read somewhere that Lauterbach, he actually, he's an important international law scholar, he actually was somewhat, you know, critical of that term, because he thought that it could be used to manipulate, as far as I understand, and I think what he does is a clear manipulation. And moreover, when he, you know, you might have seen that the Shilin of Saltivka, it's the biggest sleeping district in Ukraine. It's very huge. There are a lot of families, there are a lot of students, there are a lot of people of my age who live there. There is no strategical infrastructure, and what they do, they just, you know, cover it with guts. And that is in itself is against the international law. So those claims, they have nothing in particular. Moreover, sometimes people who are Ukrainian speaking, they might get slightly oppressed here if they go to, you know, that district, you know. So I have never, ever been discriminated for speaking Russian in my life, neither in Kharkiv, nor in Kyiv, nor in Lviv, nor even in Zakarpattia, which is, you know, the most, the western region. So that's completely made up and a very, very cynical thing to say.
And is there a, you know, in the West now, there is a lot of admiration for President Zelensky and the way he has handled events since the invasion. Do you share that, or is the view of him among Ukrainians more complicated? He seems like he's kind of a hero here, but I'm curious how you guys think of him.
For me, I myself don't know how I should estimate him. I'm not like a war strategist, so I don't know what actions that he does are good, what are bad. But I know that my mom, who used to hate him, is now, she admires him now. And a lot of Ukrainians are supporting him because they see him as a leader, who's responsible leader, who is brave. And I'm not saying every Ukrainian feels so, but there is much more respect. You know, when he came to power, there were a lot of fears that he will, you know, give up Ukraine to Putin. But actually, he puts up a fight. So a lot of Ukrainians do feel support for him. And it goes from, like, no matter who you voted for before, a lot of them do see him as a leader. And they joke also that the real leader of the free world, and, you know, make up memes about him. So, yeah, I think that it's true. Ukrainians here admire him for now.
I'm interested in your and understanding that you only speak for yourself. How do you think about Russia, Russians, and, I mean, obviously you're opposed to the current Russian regime, which is invading your country? That's an easy one. But what about the larger Ukrainian-Russian relationship? You're a Russian-speaking Ukrainian who feels very Ukrainian, and the Russian army is attacking your city. You know, what's your relationship with Russia as a country now?
I think it's a very difficult question, because I don't share the position a lot of people say it's just Putin, it's not all Russia. I feel like, I mean, somebody gets into, you know, the airplanes and somebody goes to war. It's not just him, and somebody enabled it, made it possible, whether people who are silent, whether people who listen to Russian propaganda. Like, I've listened to several stories of my friends who have relatives in Russia, and they say, like, you know, my grandmother called me and told me that, you know, Putin isn't doing anything bad. You know, you must know that there always has been an imperialist relation between those two states. And Russia sees Ukraine as its part. There is a scholar, I don't remember her name pretty well. I think she's a Pennsylvania student. She's a Black scholar who explains it very well, that, you know, Moscow sees Ukraine as the central part of Russia. And even like when I read Chekhov, for instance, who I love to read, when I see when he describes, like, we went to Poltava, which is a Ukrainian city, but he treated as Russian city, I get, you know, I get uncomfortable. I can't say that I hate Russian people. Of course I cannot, but it's very difficult to sympathize with them right now. I know that, you know, there, for instance, among the volunteers here, there are some Russian people who decided to help, and which is very admirable, and which is legally punished by their state. But I don't buy the sentiment that it's only Putin, even Navalny, before all of this, he used to be very, you know, he said that Crimea is not a butterbrot. It cannot be both Russian and Ukrainian, so it's like Russian. I don't know what are his views now, but it was, you know, it was not very negatively here. So I'm not saying anything bad about him, but I'm just saying that it's not coming from only one person. But once again, it's very complex for me to talk about it, because I know that there are some people who go to protest, and I know how scary it must feel to protest when you don't know what happens to you after that. But for those who decide to stay silent, I don't think there is a lot of respect. And I'm telling this here, you know, in a cozy place as I ran away, saying that people who are experienced the bombings, their views are of course much worse than mine. And even it doesn't matter whether they are Russian speaking, Ukrainian speaking, or even international students, because Kharkiv is a home to a lot of international students too. I don't think that they're like, they're good Russians, not all Russians, or any of that.
So what about the West? On the one hand, you're in the Czech Republic, NATO country. You know, the West has, and the rest of the world has, you know, given a lot of financial and military support to Ukraine, has also isolated Russia in a big way. On the other hand, there's, you know, it has not intervened militarily. It has not come to the active defense of Ukraine, even, and has not, you know, been willing to do the things that President Zelensky has asked, like, you know, have a no-fly zone. Do you feel supported by the West, abandoned by the West, a bit of both? How should people from Kharkiv feel about, you know, what Europe and the United States and the rest of the world have and have not been prepared to do to support them?
You know, as somebody, you know, who's in the EU country right now, I cannot say, and especially somebody who has met a lot of people who like support and, you know, treat me well, I cannot say that, you know, I don't like the actions of the EU, but you know, a lot of people, especially the ones whose houses are bombed, they do feel, I don't know if they feel betrayed, but they feel surprised, because a no-fly zone is something that Ukraine asks. Our military can cope on our own, at least that's from, I've heard like some people who are more introduced to this topic than I am, but this is the most essential part. They cannot, you know, this is what enables what they do to Saltivka in Kharkiv and other parts of Kharkiv and other cities. So we do feel somewhat betrayed. And of course, I'm not even talking about, you know, how a lot of politicians before, they were really, there were a lot of anti-corruption activists like Daria Kalinyuk, who you might have heard of when she confronted Boris Johnson. She said what Ukrainians feel very well.
And just for those listeners who don't know, what tell us about what she said.
She says actually about like, you promised us support, but you didn't deliver it. You told that you will prosecute the oligarchs, but you aren't doing it. She was very emotional. She basically says that while Ukrainian civilians die, NATO doesn't do a lot. Once again, I've discussed this issue with my friends, just being the self of politicians. And I don't understand NATO's reasons, but I do understand that there are killings of the civilians that, you know, the scary part, like when I was in my countryside house and I was so scared of two explosions, we had to run away. I was reading the group chat with my friends and they were telling like, you know, my house is shaken, or I just heard a very loud explosion, or my sky is red now. And of course you want some kind of support, but I'm not, you know, an IR major, but as our president said, partly the blood of Ukrainians might be also on their hands, as they are too scared to confront Putin, who seems actually scared of this measure.
What about the, you know, this is true in the United States. It's also true all over Western Europe. You know, the politicians, some of them of the far right and some of them of the left, who have been supportive of or tolerant of Putin over the last 15 years. You know, the most famous in the United States, of course, is Donald Trump, who also had his own very upsetting interactions with President Zelensky that, of course, led to his impeachment. But there's, you know, a bunch in Europe, too, whether it's Le Pen or Viktor Orban, or the a bunch of the right-wing parties in Italy and Spain. Has this been sort of noticed in Ukraine that Putin has an attraction to a lot of people in democratic countries who should know better?
I'm not an expert in the European politics. Actually, for a long time, I just wasn't invested at all. I knew only like the big names of some of the parties. But yes, recently, a lot of people did notice that he buys politicians, as simple as that, like whether with Gazprom places or with some other influence. I don't know much about that, but it's not up to the doubt that this exists, that some politicians, you know, maybe they just, you know, love Russian culture so much or like his ideas so much. I'm not sure whether all of the politicians you listed, like, bought by him, but they clearly sympathize him. I was really surprised by some of the U.S. politicians talking, you know, Ukraine isn't a sovereign country, even, I think.
Whom have you noticed saying that?
I remember watching Tulsi Gabbard video, and I was really scared to an extent by, you know, she's smiling and she's saying that straight up Russian propaganda, but like with smiling face, and I couldn't believe in what I heard. You know, I don't remember what she said, but that was, you know, likely a bunch of neo-Nazis or something, which isn't true, especially like if you know the history of Ukraine. Yes, there are some people who are far right, but actually, if you've seen like what's going on in Germany or other European states, there's a lot of far rightism. Even in the US, I've heard like in Florida, they had like a straight up Nazi rally, which is like in Ukraine, the Nazi symbolics are banned. So if they see you with, I don't know, swastika, you go to prison or you have some criminal liability. So it would be impossible to have a rally like this here, an open rally, of course.
So I'm curious. Your life in the Czech Republic, what language do you use in just talking to people on the street? I mean, Ukrainian or Russian and Czech are not really mutually intelligible. What do you use?
I mean, I've been here for like 3 or 4 days. I've studied Czech a little bit when I was thinking of going here to study, but then I decided to stay in Kharkiv. But I speak English mostly. I use some of the Czech phrases, but once again, I almost forgotten it. But if I decide to stay here, I will probably have to learn it because, I mean, it's the country where I would live, so I would have to learn it. It would be simply disrespectful not to learn the language of the country where I live. But I'm not sure yet. This is a great country. It's full of very nice people and an interesting culture, like, so, but I'm still thinking on what is the direction of mine.
Before I let you go, I would be remiss if I didn't ask about your father. I understand he's still in Ukraine.
Yes, my father, he actually lives in Saltivka, which I mentioned, it's one of the districts that they bombed the most. He was able to get out of his city. He's currently in another place, which is relatively safe. but it's in Ukraine. And men above 18 and before 60 and younger than 60, they cannot leave Ukraine unless they have some conditions that allow them to. But he cannot leave Ukraine. He's in a relatively safe place, so I'm not as worried about him as I was when he was in that district. But still, you know, I'm worried, and I'm worried about my stepfather, who is also there. And of course, I'm worried about all of my friends who are currently in Ukraine. But I really hope for the best, and that's not just the words. I do hope that everything will be okay, and I cannot think otherwise.
But we are going to leave it there. Katerina, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you and your family. We will be thinking about you.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was a pleasure. Thank you once again.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode, well, was me. We did it so suddenly that I just recorded it myself. So listen, people, you need to do your part to support the Lawfare Podcast, and that means getting out and tweeting episodes like this. It means, you know, sharing us on all the socials, doing all the stuff, and leaving a rating or review wherever you found us. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.